Welcome to Age Speaks here at East London Radio with me, Mervyn Eastman of Change Agents Cooperative. Today we are going to talk about a subject that is often ignored within the age industry and barely acknowledged outside of it, namely alcohol use and the over 50s. Drink Wise Age Well is an organisation aiming to start a conversation, raising awareness, overcoming stigma, and shining a light on the often hidden problems of the alcohol use of older adults. It is a real pleasure to have with us in the studio, from Cardiff, and all over the place I think, Julie, you've been, yes. Is Julie Breslin, and Julie is Head of Programme at Drink Wise and Age Well. Julie has worked in the homeless and addiction field for nearly 20 years, starting her career in Dublin and then moving, I think, to Glasgow in something 1998.
Yep, that's
it. Julie, welcome. Thank you for coming.
It's a pleasure to
Thank
be here.
Thank you for agreeing to come all the way to East London, Leytonstone.
Via Glasgow, via Cardiff.
And you're going back to
Glasgow
this evening.
Afterwards, okay. Yeah.
And it's really great to see you. Okay, let's start. Tell us about yourself. Tell us something about your upbringing, and also what took you into the homelessness and addiction field.
Okay, well, I was born in Dublin, but moved to
Dublin's fair city,
but moved to a much nicer place called Mullingar in County Westmeath when we were quite young. I'm an army child, so we didn't have that much moving about because my dad worked mostly with the UN, so he travelled a lot more overseas. Yeah. I grew up in a lovely town called Mullingar, and. I come from a family of five children.
Right.
And in terms of my interest in this area, actually probably stems very much from my dad. He, just from a very, very young age, my dad was always involved in voluntary work, charity work. And probably at a time kind of when I was growing up where the welfare system and, you know, there was a lot more charity work in late 70s, early 80s. And I just remember, you know, his values and his addressing social justice issues were just something kind of, or social injustice were things that were very apparent to me as a child. That's probably what made me want to go into this line of work. And my mum as well, have probably influenced the way I view the world.
So you were living in this environment with a culture that was very rooted in social justice and issues like that. So when you left school, did you decide to become anything?
I mean, from a very, very young age, when I look at my mum, very strange, she's kept all our copybooks from kids. And when you look back in them, I would, you know, things that I wanted to be a doctor in Africa, because that was a young Irish Catholic. As I got older, I realised I wasn't ever going to be clever enough to probably be a doctor. So social work, no offence to social workers, but that
social
was the
work's
kind of...
Much easier, yeah. Couple of years,
I knew I could at least get the university
absolutely.
Into university as a starting point. Yeah, so I started in University of Cork, another lovely, lovely place, Cork City. Yeah. So I had 3 years there doing a primary social science degree with the intention to go on and then do a master's in social work. But from that, I moved to Dublin and worked for a charity at the time that was called Focus Point and is now called Focus Ireland and works with homeless people.
Okay.
And I went there for a kind of almost apprenticeship kind of one-year placement, but enjoyed it so much, ended up staying there for a number of years. And my work there, I was an outreach worker, so I worked in Dublin City Centre at mostly night time to...
Well, this is around Rough Sleepers, was it?
In Rough Sleepers. Yeah, working very much at Rough Sleepers. And young, very young Rough Sleepers. We were particularly targeting young people. So a lot of young, very young travellers. You'd come across and sleep in Rough, like come across a whole row of sleeping bags with quite young children out sleeping Rough. So did that for a couple of years. And then I decided to move to Glasgow because my mother's from Glasgow. And I have a lot of family, and I have a brother I'm very close to who had moved over previously, and moved here, and I continue to work with Rough Sleepers.
So you still kept to that? Yeah.
In the homelessness field for a couple of years in a fantastic place called the Wayside Centre. And then I went back to university at that stage and did a postgrad in addiction studies because I had seen the very, very strong link around homelessness, mental health and addiction. And it became an area I really wanted to understand from a more theoretical framework. So did my postgrad in addiction studies. And then since then, I've worked in various, worked in statutory social work services for in community addiction teams.
Was that in Ireland as well?
No, everything's been in Glasgow since. Okay. I've been in Glasgow since and met a man from Glasgow and got married. And so I've been living here ever since.
Okay. And how did you get sort of into the world of, if like the age industry, aging and so on and so forth? Where did that come from?
So when I started working, it was quite generic addiction services. I worked with people with both drug and alcohol problems, and then as I moved forward and I kind of went into more senior positions and management, I started to manage alcohol services in Glasgow. Okay. And they were for anybody aged over 18. And what we were just seeing regularly was, I'll say the word older drinkers, but I mean that kind of anybody aged 50 and over, to make it easier. But older adults with alcohol problems.
And this is some years ago.
So this was about 90, probably, no, let me think, where are we now? This was probably about, 2010, was just what we were, I was picking up from the team, and what we were talking about was this very hidden population that were tended to, drinking behind doors, closed doors, very, very isolated, lots of other complex health problems. And generally within addiction services in Glasgow, you will get referred into a treatment service, particularly if your health needs, you need an alcohol detox or
Did
something.
Did Scotland have drug advisory teams at that stage, or was that just an English sort of?
We had ADPs, had kind of equivalent of that. We've actually moved on, so drug and alcohol action teams through to alcohol drug partnerships now, abbreviations.
I chaired a drug action team for a while.
Which would be that kind of stakeholder approach.
So,
and one of the things what would happen if somebody eventually found the courage maybe to go to their doctor or their GP and say they were experiencing problems with their drinking, they would get a referral into one of the treatment services. And the treatment services, like they can probably be in many areas, are in areas of very, very high deprivation. The one where I worked, in most days there was police, ambulance outside, there was something happening. It was quite a scary area to be in. Very, very mixed groups, so you would have anything from a young man that's maybe just come straight out of prison who's waiting to get a methadone script to child protection cases. So you would walk into these waiting rooms of just absolute chaos sometimes.
Was it mainly men, or did it
across the board in addictions, it's generally been about a mix of it's 30% female and 70. But that might have slightly shifted. But I suppose my point is, I think if you were somebody that had eventually gone to your doctor and had said you were, had an alcohol problem, that was your first contact with services. You were expected to walk in, and even things like the assessments done, they were very, very generic treatment assessments, questions on it, like how do you fund your habit? And if you're sitting there as a 68-year-old who's maybe been drinking because you've lost a partner, it was the language of that, and also, picking up via assessment particular issues that might be more identifiable for older adults, such as medication or, isolation issues. So we were really conscious of this, and we thought there's no service designed to respond to this group, and actually they're falling through the net, and they get referred and cases get closed.
And that was across the board in terms of all generations. Not just particularly older people.
We were seeing this particularly for older adults. Seeing it very much so that we were just finding that we were really, really concerned about this group just not getting referred and not engaging. Right. And it was like, what are we doing wrong?
And they weren't on the radar at all, were they?
They might get picked up by health services. They might end up in hospital, for example, because they've had a fall related to their drinking and then get referred into treatment services. But that journey is not happening. Yeah. That journey and that. To give you a real live example, we had a referral once for a woman whose drinking had increased following the death of her husband. Now, she'd been in his care while he had terminal cancer and had started drinking at that point. And then when he died, her drinking escalated hugely. Her GP initially referred her into treatment services, but she didn't. She wasn't opening her mail at that point. Do you know what I mean? She wasn't even actually looking and at mail coming in. Her life was in that much chaos. So at that stage, our service was set up, the over 50s alcohol service, and we were able to, that day, go out, chap her door, go in, meet with her, build a relationship, help her deal with some practical issues, try and get her immediate health needs met before we even started to look at that journey into treatment as such. And that's how we modelled the service. We knew that there was a number of principles, had to be based on home visits. It had to be about actually reaching out to people that maybe wouldn't have made that or couldn't have made that engagement in. And, you know, we developed assessment tools that looked at much more the whole person, including issues that related to their ageing. And another element that we developed in the programme was peer support, because research shows that, particularly with the over 50s, they'll respond better in a peer-to-peer setting with other people with the same life experiences. So we set up that aspect of the programme as well. Managed to get big lottery funding to do that, and that service ran for 3 years with really brilliant outcomes, but didn't get funded at the end. It just, this population were not a priority on anybody's radar, and that was the huge frustration for us.
Interesting. Were there differences in terms of the demographic and social class? So people accessing, seems to me from what you're saying, Julie, that there's a sense of, you know, fairly middle class people suffering a lot or whatever, or was it working class? Was it middle class? Was it across the classes?
Total mix for us, absolute total mix. Okay. I mean, certainly depending on socioeconomic status, the harms caused by alcohol will be very, very different. Yeah. But actually, middle class will drink more, consume more alcohol, but actually the harm is experienced more. But the actual life issues experienced by the boat, they're the same. Exactly. Everyone goes through loss. Everyone goes through, you know, changes in kind of the family structures, all that happens to different people. So that was across the board.
Because often I think that we, in the age industry, whatever, don't take enough account of differences of class.
Oh, absolutely.
And a lot of the services are geared wrongly, in my view. So I just wanted to tease that out of you, which is good.
No, there was an absolute mix. Routine, I'm trying to think, was routine even different? What you may have found is people that were maybe hadn't come into services yet for quite a while, because they had been still working and quite hidden, and their alcohol use was almost seen as quite what's the word, it was sociable, career related.
I could finish a bottle in the evening,
Those problems start to whereas, you know, maybe people that had been longer term drinkers, there would have been other associated factors. That actually comes out from our original survey findings, that they might have been long term out of work anyway, have had other health and issues that made them unable to work. So there's some factors there that tie in.
Okay. Drink-wise, age well. Now, I attended some time ago a big lottery consultation event, and they were exploring issues that they wanted to look at in relation to older people. And alcohol came up. And the general consensus of the audience or the group was, well, you know, yeah, it could be a bit of a problem, but the generic services around alcohol and whatever would deal with that. That was the general consensus around that meeting. And then the next thing I heard was that the big lottery had invested in Drinkwise Age Well. Tell us how that came about and how you came about, basically. So, does that make sense?
I mean, you're going back, I suppose, about to 2014, when it wasn't Drinkwise Age Well. The grant was called the Rethink Good Health Fund, which came through the National Lottery, Big Lottery Fund. I'm not sure they're called the National Lottery from via the Big Lottery Fund. I mean, we were really, really grateful that Big Lottery Fund were recognising this issue. We had struggled to get it through, you know, area planning teams or commissioners. And certainly our trends are showing us that across the population, harmful drinking is reducing in everybody except older adults.
Why was that the case? Why was the commissioners and others reluctant to see it as an issue or priority in terms of older drinkers? What do you think that was about?
I think in a field like addiction, if you cover that whole field, there's a lot of priorities. So you have things like child protection. It's the one care area, if that's the right word, that care and health area that covers lot from birth to the end of life. So you have child protection issues that are a priority. You have criminal justice issues. You've got mental health issues. You've got young people. You've got young people affected by parental alcohol and drug use. So we see that, and we see it still reflected in strategy. We see that still very much reflected in the UK-wide strategy, where I think, the alcohol strategy recognises and identifies older adults twice and young people 26 times in that, yet the population, younger populations drinking is reducing. So there's been no reflection of that demographic shift. I think it's just, it's not been a priority.
Okay, so how did the Big Lottery, how did they go about that? Did they invite tenders? How did you get involved?
Yeah, the first we were aware there was an open day discussion and lots of different partners came along to find out more about the programme, and there was key kind of stipulations of the grant. It had to be across the UK, it had to have expertise in both alcohol and ageing, it had to influence both practice and policy. So that just brought lots of people together, and my organisation that I work for is called Ad Action. It's a behaviour change charity that's been around since 1967, following a letter written by a woman called Molly Craven to The Guardian about her son's heroin problem. She was very involved in the setup at that stage. So we've worked for many, many years, the organisation, to tackle harm caused by alcohol and drugs. And so Ad Action had already had a lot of interest from delivering our programme in Glasgow, and we just thought, this is fantastic, this is great, this is what we wanted to happen, this is what we wanted to see. So we did through our website, invited expression of interests, and we did a bit of, we identified some organisations that we knew already quite well. So for example, Addiction NI.
Yeah.
Who's our partner in Northern Ireland. Yeah. We'd worked with them previously and we'd met with them at conferences because they had a similar service called Older Focus in Northern Ireland. And Substance Misuse and Ageing Research Team from the University of Bedfordshire. We'd worked with their director, Sarah Wadd, who's a fantastic, brilliant researcher who's done a lot of work in this area. So we came together and we created a strategic group, which comprises of Ad Action as the lead partner, Royal Voluntary Service, Addiction NI, Developing a Caring Wales, and the Substance Misuse and Ageing Research Team. And we also worked alongside a policy partner, which was ILC UK.
Okay.
So we came together, and there was two stages of the application. The first stage was just to put the initial plan in stage one of what we felt we wanted to do at the programme. And then we were successful, and there was a second stage of application where we really got down to the nitty-gritty of what the programme would look like.
And what sort of funding were you asking for? What were they offering?
The grant was £25 million over 7 years, which sounds huge, and especially in current climate and austerity, but it is it was across the UK.
So how did you get to be where you are in terms of the programme director?
Well, I obviously had that experience of the initial service that we had in Glasgow. So when Ad Action had decided to look at going for this fund, I was part of steering group, still doing my day job as such, which was managing an alcohol behaviour change service in Glasgow, but became involved in I had already done a lot of research, a lot of background information, so helped with the first initial bit of application writing. And when we successfully got through to the stage two, part of that was funding a development worker post, which I went for and got. So I had 6 months of really, as I said, getting the application into a good place with our strategic partners. And then once we got that part of the design, there was a head of programme job. And again, I went to, because obviously this is all Big Lottery funded, all the jobs were external.
It could be hard to pay money for you, wouldn't it?
So came back, it's been something I have a real passion for. So, and I've been just so lucky to be able to be on this journey and have this opportunity from the Big Lottery Fund.
Okay, so, one in five, I've got this from you, one in five of over 50s are drinking. And increasing risk levels. Now, when I saw that, And for the listeners, because I did a bit of research on it. What are those risk levels? How does that, what are the risk levels in relation to drinking over the age of 50?
So that statistic comes from a screening called the Alcohol Use Alcohol Use Identification Disorder or something. Yeah, sorry, audit tool is what it's called. And we did that screening through a survey of nearly 17,000 people aged over 50. And in that...
17,000 people drawn across the UK?
Yeah, in our demonstration control sites. So okay, we selected, there was 10 sites where this survey
and that were the
was
10 sites were across the UK?
Yes. Okay. And that screening, there was a survey that went out via GP practices, because what we wanted at the start of this programme, because it will be fully evaluated, is a baseline of alcohol use and behaviour and attitudes.
17,000 is a lot.
Nearly 70,000. I think it was 16,700.
Yeah, that's still a lot. Yeah.
So, amazing data. Really, really good data to kind of work on. And so we used a screening tool to measure, and the screening tool has a score that looks at people who are either lower risk, increasing risk, or higher risk, are dependent drinkers, and it's used in clinical settings. So the 1 in 5 figures of those that were drinking, they were drinking at levels that if they continue to drink at that level, will start to experience harms associated with alcohol use.
Talk to us about the harms.
So the harms can be, there's obviously there's acute harms. There's harms that can happen in terms of, as I say, especially as we all age, our bodies change, our metabolism changes, so we're not breaking down alcohol as quickly as we would have been able to before, hence even hangovers will feel like quite differently. But also older adults were more likely on different medications, so there's risks of that. Impact of alcohol on medications, falls and injuries. What you'll tend to see is the real acute drinking harms is in a younger population. It's intoxication, it's fights, it's falls in the city centre at night time. But with older adults, it might be a little bit more cumulative harm that takes a bit more time. So it could be things like medication not working. If somebody's on heart medication, for example, is there an impact of that alcohol use on that, or diabetes? Alcohol's related to 60 different health conditions, and we know there's a much stronger link to cancer now than previously. It's linked to 7 different cancers. And that's before you're looking at other risks like liver damage, liver cirrhosis, and stuff like, I don't think people kind of appreciate with something like liver damage and liver cirrhosis, it takes a long time to detect. So people may have liver function tests and go, no, I'm fine, and continue drinking at quite heavy levels. And actually, at the point that it is detected, the damage is done. So there's those risks. There's other risks as well around mental health, anxiety, depression, and alcohol also affects things like sleep. So your sleep patterns change as you get older. And I think there's an assumption that alcohol helps people sleep. It doesn't. It disrupts our sleep rhythms. So it has impacts on lots of different things.
Things like relationship problems and issues around quality of life and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, even from a point of domestic violence, alcohol is very, very highly identified in incidents of domestic violence. So that's a huge risk. But it can even just have an impact on relationships. We have a lot of families that come forward to us looking for support because they're struggling with a loved one's drinking. It can have even things around elder abuse. There can be risks around that. I've certainly worked with people myself over the years where I have seen family members buy them alcohol in order to exploit, exploit situations. So it can be used in quite a sinister way as well. So, there's a lot of other social and psychological factors related to alcohol use that are quite risky.
In terms of your experience, Julie, and the survey and the work you've done, looking at the over 50s, now we're inclined to lump everyone is over 50.
Yes.
So we go from 50 to 98, 102.
Yeah, and you could have 3 generations.
Absolutely.
Totally.
And therefore, talk to us a little bit about are there differences, what are the challenges within the generations? Because as you say, there are 3-4 generations of within the 50s. The baby boomers particularly, of which I am one. are seen to be at particular risk.
Yeah.
Both in terms of numbers
yeah.
of the baby boomers. Yeah. And also, you know, in the 1960s, 70s, you know.
Drinking culture changed.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Talk to us about that.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's something we struggle with. And that's why on the outset I said I'm going to refer to over 50s as older adults, and like, but I know as soon as I'm saying that that's it.
We all do.
But you're absolutely right, and that has been, you know, one of the big lottery requirements is that this is over 50s, because they see quite the preventative approach within it in that population who are under 65 coming up to that stage. So that's why we kind of encompass everything. But you're right, there is different responses to different groups. There certainly is that baby boomer population that have been drinking more, but alongside that there's more universal factors, if you want to call it that, of alcohol has become so much more affordable since the 1980s. I mean, it's 60% more affordable since the 1980s. So and that's the stage you would have been, kind of that baby boomer generation, going into work, having children, going through that. So I even remember with my parents, I remember that treat was the bottle of Blue Nun on a Saturday night.
Blue Nun. Oh, do we not remember the blue? Yes, Baby Shame, Blue Nun, absolutely.
But you know, my dad would have go and have a pint and pick up. They would also get a takeaway and have that, and that was that was it. But you know, as you know, their drinking patterns changed as alcohol became more affordable. And when you look at the graph around that, you see as alcohol has become more affordable, the harm has massively increased. So you've had that baby boomer population have more income,
yes,
being able to have more. You know, freedom of what and alcohol is much more available. So all those factors means you have that population who are, if they continue, and they've also, the other factor is, has taken that drinking behaviour into into their later years. And if that continues in that way, what we will potentially see is an increase. We're seeing already, I mean, kind of 55 to 64 year olds are the highest incidence of hospital admissions, but actually in Scotland the national records for alcohol debts have recorded the highest incidence ever of alcohol debts in the over 75s. This is a pattern that's continuing, and actually we need to look at much more targeted prevention messages as well as access to treatment for this population.
Where did the title come from, Drink Wise, Age Well? I actually quite like it.
It was.
I won't talk about Vintage Village, but I will.
Oh, I know. I know. But that was tested as well, and I knew it would have a mixed response.
No, I'm teasing.
But it was. To be honest, it was all the kind of strategic partners coming together, and we looked at a number of different names, and we did a bit of, discussions with active service users who were already in program around it, and together we came up at Drink Wise, Age Well.
And I think it's good. I like
that. But what we wanted to do is, it's not an abstinence-based program.
No, no.
Our aim is to help people make healthier choices about their alcohol use. Yeah. We're not saying to people do not drink, and actually recognise that alcohol use can be quite a sociable aspect of somebody's life. Yeah. And we really want to see things like, pubs, places that are social, places that bring people together, are really, really important. So we wanted to make sure the message wasn't one that suggested
What I meant to have asked as well a bit earlier on, I should have done, was in terms of the, I'm not sure we teased out the specific aims of Drink Wise, Age Well.
Yeah.
So if you were to list, what is it that you are evaluating at the end of the day in terms of your input, what would those objectives be?
Yeah, I mean, we've kind of got four key outcomes that we're wanting to achieve. As I said, the overall is it's that people will make healthier choices, but that's done through things like we want to raise awareness that, first of all, there is a problem, and a better understanding and increase knowledge and understanding around things like units and understanding guidelines.
Is that within the over 50s or increased knowledge generally?
In the over 50s. Okay. And again, the survey that we talked about showed a low level of knowledge, just basic knowledge about what units are. So so the first thing is about increasing awareness, knowledge, and also reducing stigma, so that people who do start to talk about their alcohol use are heard in a sympathetic way, in an understanding way. So so the program kind of has the model of the program kind of has a wider population reach initially, where we're going out there to try and shift attitudes and awareness around alcohol use in the wider population. We then look a bit more targeted at people who are at risk of developing an alcohol problem, most likely due to things like life transitions, our retirement, bereavement. And that was one of the key reasons people cited as increased alcohol use. So what we want to do is increase resilience so that people are less likely to develop an alcohol problem. And then we have a more targeted approach of working with people who are drinking now to reduce the harmful effects of alcohol use on their health and well-being. But we also do a training element of the programme where we try to have a ripple effect in communities in order to engage, so we do loads of training, we train with frontline staff, practitioners, carers, so that everybody is able to spot, recognise and respond to somebody who's having an alcohol problem, and ultimately we will see a reduction in alcohol harm in this population.
How big's the organisation? Because that's a big ask.
So, if you look at the Drinkwise HVL programme, is a partnership. It's not an organisation. And I think that's it. So, Ad Action's the lead partner with those partners I mentioned earlier on. But it's not an organisation or a charity on its own. We are a programme delivered within. But to give it some scale, so there's 18 delivery partners. We deliver the programme in 5 UK sites. So we're in the Western Trust in Northern Ireland, Glasgow, Sheffield, Devon and Cumtaf in Wales. Mm-hmm. And each of those areas, the programme's delivered by those 18 partners.
So you're focused on particular what you might call demonstration
sites. There's a model that's an evaluated model, and we've used a community systems approach where we're in communities delivering all those aspects that I just described.
Absolutely.
And the hope is the compounded impact of all those different activities and going to multiple layers of the population, we'll have a better chance of reducing alcohol harm in that population. We've got control areas that we will evaluate against.
Okay.
As I said, we have a fantastic research team involved, led by the Substance Misuse and Ageing Research team. So there's 18 partners. There's at last count, I think we have 130 staff across the 5 UK sites, and we've now got, probably 70, 80 volunteers. And that's been a big, important part of the programme, was this understanding that, for example, bringing peer educators in and making sure that if we're going into somewhere like a pre-retirement group, that actually can we identify people who will continue to deliver those awareness sessions, that ripple effect out in the community. We've got someone in Sheffield now who's a veteran, who's skilled up, he's a peer educator and he's a volunteer. So he's taken his experiences of both, armed services as a veteran, and he goes into veteran groups and delivers sessions.
It's still quite a small, in relative terms, it's actually quite a small partnership in one level, isn't it, in terms of the number of people involved.
Not when I'm doing the grants and the budgets,
I know what you mean. Relatively speaking.
Okay.
Because, as I said, it's a big ask. Are you pleased about how things are going so far?
I think it is a big ask. You're absolutely right. What's really important. So my job as head of programme is to manage that partnership and all those different 18 partners and making sure they're delivering to the kind of objectives and outcomes that we've set. And so I go out and do an awful lot of site visits and see what's happening on the ground. And when I see that, because I kind of get caught into the nitty gritty of targets and outcomes, and then you actually go out and you see what's going on the ground, and it's fantastic, amazing work that's happening. I can't say to you until we redo that survey. It's hard to know, and I think that's one of the risks about this program, and certainly that really the big evaluation at the end will tell us what difference made. But what we do in the meantime is we do lots of kind of outcome scales with people that we support. So we're seeing, for example, people that are receiving the one-to-one interventions around their alcohol use. We're using things like the Warwick Edinburgh Wellbeing Scale. We're seeing improvements in anxiety, depression. Alcohol use is increasing decreasing problem drinking. We do other things as well. We do things like cognitive screenings because we want to see, and actually very concerningly with that population, I mean, 30% of people that we screen are scoring in the normative range. So that's 70% of people in the mild to severe.
Sure.
And I think, a very, very conscious part of active and healthy aging is brain health. And I think just, for us, this screen is a really important thing to be saying to people, is actually the impact that alcohol may have on that can be particular significant. So you're trying to always find the motivating factors that will be important to somebody. So I'm happy on the ground when I see the difference it's making day to day to people's lives. And just the creative approaches that the areas have done. So, for example, in Northern Ireland, they did a big event in the summer called Drinkwise and Jive. But in Northern Ireland, there's a very, very big country music culture that takes place in pubs and clubs. And they said, well, how are we going to engage with that wider over 50s population who won't even want to get into conversation? So this whole kind of social marketing approach of months leading up to doing Jive classes, but within that lots of alcohol health messaging, then referral routes into other aspects of the program if people were looking for more support. And on the day, they attempted to break a record doing at the largest Jive ever in Derry. But on the day there was loads of health mobile units set up, so you were bringing people together to do an activity but whilst giving a message around their drinking. Okay. So there's been some really creative approaches, and one of the other strengths of the programme is that partnership is working. So yesterday, for example, we were in Cardiff for the Do Not Go Gentle conference, which was bringing people together to look at substance misuse and older adults. And you just see all these partners coming together who were really, really keen to address this. Because also yesterday, interesting, although we're talking about alcohol today, we're looking at things like over-the-counter medication, prescription-only medication, and our increasing population of drug users substance misusers that are going into older age now, and how we are going to respond to that. So really, really brilliant event yesterday.
One of the areas I wanted to get into, and this is not a surprise to you, is that your report Calling Time, which addresses ageism and age discrimination in terms of policy, practice and research. And you were kind enough to have invited me to talk about ageism, but I couldn't make it because of the heart scare, which was a great disappointment, because I was actually very much looking forward to that. Very much so. I won't talk about on air the replacement that you used. But that's a different.
He was wonderful.
That's a different story. Yeah. So he told me.
He was.
He did enjoy depping for me. he had this fairly perverse enjoyment. Paul Cann, if you're listening to this, we wish you well. Okay, let's talk about ageism. Let's talk about age discrimination. Can you tell us some of the key messages from this particular piece of work that you did, because I think that ageism discrimination is incredibly powerful in terms of where we are and why we're where we are. Talk to us about that.
I mean, a really general overview: older adults are the least likely age group to access treatment for an alcohol problem. But they have better outcomes than any other age group.
Very good point.
And I think that's the starting point in the frustration I've had as a practitioner for many years. And Sarah Wadd, who is our researcher, who was co-author on this, has found in the world of research that there is cut-off ages across things in research. I remember the stat was about 48% of the stuff that they surveyed had a cut-off age in alcohol research. So there's not even an investment to understand an aging population. It's when we were, to be really honest, when we started, we knew it was there. We know it exists. We see it in our practice day to day. Sarah has seen it in research. We could see it in policy when we were talking to ILC UK. And then we started to go and write this down, and we were kind of going, but have we enough evidence for a report to actually really go out and call it and say, look, enough is enough. And then we started to bring it all together, and we're going, we really do. We really do, even at a kind of, as I said, that strategic level, where neither the Scotland Alcohol Strategy or the current UK strategy recognise the needs of older adults at all. But then you look at the Welsh strategy that is you know, really, really understanding of older people, older adults needs to set up an advisory group on substance misuse. So you need to understand, well, why is there a difference there? But even things like collection of key prevalence rates and data around alcohol use. So many have a cutoff of 65 or 75, and you're suddenly going, what, do you stop having an alcohol problem when you're when you're 75 years of age? And I've just said that statute about the highest rate of over 75 deaths, you know. And so you start to put all this stuff together. And we also did a survey on practitioners and asked them about everyday kind of ageism. And some of the stuff that came back, it just didn't surprise us. You know, people are too old to change. They're a more difficult group to work with. It's their last pleasure in life. You know, all this stuff that, that's
so
just
right.
based on assumption.
You are so right.
But I think the really shocking thing that came out from research Sarah had already done with funding from Alcohol Research UK was around the alcohol rehabs. And she went into the Directory of Public Health England to look at accessibility of rehabs, and three quarters of them have arbitrary age cut off. And you're just thinking, right, so I think she said, once you're past 65, 50% of rehabs are not available. And the risk around that is people can end up in things like care homes or long-term hospital stays where their primary issue is alcohol. And there's no reason why somebody should not have the same right to that treatment, no matter what age they are. And I think it's something you see in mental health as well. You'll see this, you know... I'm sorry if this stat is wrong, but I remember reading something. I think it was people over 65 were six times more likely to be prescribed medication than talking therapy.
Yes.
Now that might, the figure might be wrong, but you know, it's that kind of stuff that you're just treating the problem and not the individual. But the rehab stuff really, really stood out. And if you look into Sarah's study, she's another study around that. It was even just some of the attitudes within rehabs and some of the intimidation that went on, or just even things like it, you know, the design of the program is geared towards younger people, so you're excluding people who are maybe there in person but are not able to get involved in what's happening. So we just felt, once we looked at all of that together, that we felt very, very strongly that this is not right, and it needs to be addressed. And I just, like, I remember having a conversation with somebody who, because I contacted them, they had a rehab and they had a cut-off age, and I said, well, why is it? Just why do you have it? And they were like, oh, we don't have the staff to get a 72-year-old in and out of the bath. And you're going, well, why do you think that 70-year-old might need help in about any more than a 42-year-old who's been a long-term injecting drug user who might have mobile? You should make sure your rehab's accessible to everybody, including people whose mobility might be affected. That's not an age factor. So you just start to see that. So we ended up with this report and made some key recommendations in it. We thought about the audiences we wanted to engage, and the recommendations in it look at government level, where we're saying, no, your strategy
You've read my prompting.
Oh,
now,
I'm sorry. I'll stop and let you ask the next question. I do talk.
No, brilliant. I wanted to home in on those recommendations, because I thought this report was brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
A really good report, and I have read some rubbish. But this is good, good.
I mean,
simple, accessible.
George and Sarah led on the report writing.
So tell us about the recommendations in terms of the alcohol strategies, you know, who we're addressing, national policies, and so on and so forth. Take us through that.
I mean, one of our challenges, is we are a UK-wide programme, and you start to do a report like this, and you have to be responsive to each of the national governments and think about what exists where it doesn't exist somewhere else. So these were a challenge in themselves to get nailed down. But so, as we said, we started at that kind of national government level and said that, you know, your strategy must start so that from the top down, that you understand the needs of an older population in relation to substance misuse, and that, you know, we've made specific recommendations about convening an advisory panel similar to the ones in Wales to improve guidelines across the board, but also even things like in Northern Ireland. I mean, I wasn't aware before being involved in this report that the quality law doesn't come under goods and services, which social care does. So even that basic in Northern Ireland, that's one of the key recommendations that we put in there. And you know, the Quality Commissioner of Northern Ireland was fantastic about this and getting on board and saying, you know, being aware that we really need to address this as well. We also look at, so that issue that I raised about stats is that national public bodies, they need to be, we need to be able to tell the story. We need to understand what's happening within, across all ages in our population. So grouping of ages together, says us, who's an over 50s alcohol service. But, you know, that grouping of 65 and over in alcohol prevalence rates, no, we need to get a better understanding and break that down. Don't kind of break everything down by 10 years and then say 65 and over. I saw one that was 18... 40 and then 40 and over, and I thought, oh, that, there you go, that's a whole so making sure that we're getting data, we're collecting data that breaks down and understands. And then from a commissioning point of view, is making sure that commissioners and regulators, the CQC, if they're going into review a rehab or a treatment service, that they're asking questions around different age groups and how the program's successful. And I certainly know from when I've run services that have been commissioned, you get asked lots of different things around gender and women accessibility and you know, BME accessibility. How are you making sure the service? Age never came up. Age was never a conversation. So we want that to be a normal conversation within services, and we want service providers to think about it in their practice, not necessarily. We don't expect everybody to set up a DrinkWise Age Well programme. We don't have the resources to do that, but we want people to think about their practice every day within their work.
Absolutely.
And then obviously the research community needs to be a lot more clear about why it would, you know, unless it's specifically that's what the research is around an age group, they shouldn't be having cut-off ages. So we have different areas that we're trying to address with this report.
If you look at the recommendations, I mean, they're not vast, but there's a number of them. And as you pointed out, Julie, you've got national governments, public bodies, commissioners, the providers of actual services, research community. Are you optimistic, by and large, that
we are starting to see things
You're going to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things in there, for example, you know, in Northern Ireland already, I think it's the public health agency that we're collecting stats on had a cut-off age at 75. They've changed that following us saying, look, you know, why? I mean, these are easy fixes, and that's Sarah made that point yesterday because she presented on the report.
So
these don't cost money. This isn't actually the cost of doing nothing is far more risky. So, you know, we're seeing those changes start to happen. I was in the Scottish Government chambers listening to a parliamentary discussion on alcohol harm, and was delighted to hear them talk about actually understanding an older population better. You're starting to hear these conversations much more. So, we think there definitely is shifts starting to happen, and some great people working across the field who are advocating for this, both you know in the UK and internationally, who are really, really looking for this to be addressed. You know, you've got Tony Rao and, you know, Sarah Wadd that are constantly talking about these issues. So I think we are starting to make progress.
What's your greatest fear?
The sustainability side of things is obviously a concern, especially with our programme, where we're delivering so much in the community. But what I'm always conscious of is this is not about DrinkWise Age Well legacy. This is about the issue of the theme. So what we need to get better at going into we've got 2 more years of operational delivery, is really sharing the learning and saying, look, this is how you do it, and this is why. And what I keep kind of getting asked about this stage is the kind of cost-benefit analysis question, which actually got asked an awful lot in relation to this report when we presented it to kind of key government people. And it really frustrated me, because I said, you wouldn't be asking about the money if this was any other ism, if it was, you know, any other level of discrimination. You would not be saying, well, what's the cost of it? It's the right thing to do. But I still do think we have to show some level of evidence of actually, if we don't invest in this, this is what the outcomes will be. I was in Westminster last week, so it was a cross-party group where we had one of our beneficiary service users, Vince, that had come along with me. And what I was struck about was, and what we talked about afterwards, was that you're not a recipient. you're not a recipient all the time of this service. And he facilitates our peer recovery groups. He, you know, is looking at other aspects of volunteering within the group, and that's what I actually want us to be outnumbered by that at the end as the paid staff as such, because that's what's really, really important, that somebody isn't this passive recipient of our help.
Absolutely.
They become very active in how the program gets designed and moves on. Yeah. So absolutely, you're very, very right. But just on that thing, so I suppose, so I won't, you haven't brought it up because I know we had email words about the Vintage Street campaign.
Come on.
I'm brave enough to do it. But I want to make the point that felt like such a huge responsibility of getting that wrong, because ultimately where that started from was how do we reduce the stigma?
Yeah.
And we did lots of focus groups with people coming through our service, but also just people in communities and talking about and understanding what were the things. And it was about, it's behind closed doors, it's hidden, it's the stuff that could happen to any of us. Enough of that othering,
any of us
could go through this.
Yeah.
And that's when we got to the point, we said, well, we wanted to look from the outside in at stuff that will happen to any of us.
Yeah.
So that, you know, we will, whoever, people that are in work will retire at some point in life. And what's that journey like for somebody, and what happens? And everybody thinks it's going to be great. It's you know, people will think that something positive, but the reality might be different for some other people. And that's what we wanted to get across. But yeah, I had a real, and I still, you know, it's out there now, but it's that you have that responsibility of not ever othering or by trying to reduce the stigma, that compassionate ageism sets in.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is, yeah, that's
good.
That's a risk.
That's good. That's good. That's great. We are coming to the end of the show, Julie. Have you enjoyed yourself?
It's flown by. Yeah,
yeah, it's good.
Really, really interesting discussion. Definitely.
Absolutely brilliant.
And delighted to have had this opportunity.
What do you do when you're not doing what you do? What interests and activities do you get engaged in?
Well, we spoke earlier. I have a wonderful dog.
Oh, right. We spoke about this off air, if I recall. Yes, you've got a Labrador.
We were talking about a wonderful dog. Shout out to Cora. And she, if we'll be listening, of course, because it's not the other radio station I talked about. And she is...
You mean BBC Radio 4.
Yeah, she doesn't like for some reason. Yes. But anyway, she
doesn't
is...
Doesn't like John Humphreys.
She doesn't, just certain things she doesn't like on it. They upsets her. But she, so walking her, lots of, you know, I live in, you know, Glasgow, and literally half an hour out the road, you're into Loch Lomond side, you're into the most beautiful walks ever.
Yeah.
So that's probably you know, the most enjoyable is downtime, and obviously the obvious spending time with friends and families and enjoying good food and you know,
and
occasionally a drink.
And enjoying music that I've never heard of.
And enjoying
I enjoy travelling.
And travel, all the
Excellent.
Yes.
Can we say thank you so much for coming into the studio? Thank you for what I think has been a great conversation. And I just really want to say I've been very impressed with what I've seen, what I've read, what I've heard. Julie, thank you very much. Have a safe journey back.
I'll do.
And it's been great to meet you.
You too, Mervyn. Thank you so much.
You have been listening to Age Speaks here at East London Radio. We hope you've enjoyed the show. And until next time,